Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, August 29th. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Klamath River Restoration Milestone, fish swims freely for the first time in over a century. Counties combat forced labor on illegal cannabis farms, and annual sheepdog trials will be held this September at the Mendocino County Fairgrounds in Boonville. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. For the first time in more than 100 years, fish are swimming freely in the Klamath River, thanks to a major restoration project involving state, federal, and tribal collaboration. The project, which is the largest of its kind in American history, aims to remove 4 outdated hydroelectric dams in California and Oregon that have long harmed water quality and salmon populations, according to a press release from the office of Governor Gavin Newsom. 2 key cofferdams at Iron Gate and Copco No. 1 were breached, restoring the river to a free-flowing state in California. This opens up over 400 miles of habitat for native fish species like steelhead, coho, and Chinook salmon, allowing them access to critical spawning and rearing areas. The restoration is also expected to boost the culture and economy for several tribes in the Klamath Basin. Governor Gavin Newsom, who visited the site in June, emphasized that this moment reflects California's commitment to correcting historical wrongs. The dam removal project, which started last September, continues throughout this year with the involvement of the Yurok and Karuk tribes, Pacific Corps, and other environmental and fishing groups. The Klamath River was once the 3rd largest salmon-producing river on the West Coast, but dam construction beginning in 1918 severely restricted fish migration. With the final approval from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission last December, this restoration marks a significant step toward revitalizing nearly 400 miles of historical habitat. In line with these efforts, Governor Newsom has also launched California's first strategy to restore salmon populations amid the challenges of climate change, and the state has invested over $800 million in the past 3 years to protect this iconic species. The governor has requested a federal fishery disaster declaration to support communities affected by the ongoing closure of the ocean salmon season. A 3-year grant is paying for Humboldt County's part in a regional effort to combat human trafficking on illegal cannabis farms. Daniel Mintz reports.
Humboldt County's sheriff says Northern California's illegal cannabis farming is rife with labor exploitation, and it's going to be addressed with new grant-funded staff. 3 new sheriff's office positions were approved at the August 27th Board of Supervisors meeting. Sheriff Billy Hansel said Humboldt's control of illegal cannabis is effective, but bad actors have been pushed into or have migrated to nearby counties. Humboldt is part of a 5-county coalition in a region where illegal cannabis production has exponentially blown up, Hansel said. He described how the NorCal counties banded together to tackle a dilemma that any one can't deal with on its own.
Several county sheriffs, initially Butte County, Lake, Mendocino, Trinity, Humboldt, all got together and discussed this. What can we do in Northern California? With shrinking budgets, with our similar concerns, what can we do? And so we talked about forming a coalition of counties and a nonprofit to seek funding for a collective goal, and that was to eliminate, or at least address, I shouldn't say eliminate because it will never happen, but address human and labor trafficking associated with illegal cannabis operations, transnational crime, organized crime dealing with illegal cannabis operations, as well as environmental damage that's associated with illegal cannabis operations.
The 3 positions paid for through Humboldt's $334.6 thousand of grant funding over 3 years are a public information officer, an evidence technician, and a program manager. They'll support efforts against human trafficking. Hansel said cannabis prices have dropped steeply And with less money churned, cost-cutting leads to labor exploitation.
When we come in to do our search warrants on marijuana grows, we suspect that there's labor trafficking going on. Labor has become the biggest liability when it comes to growing marijuana now. When you used to grow it for $3,000 or sell it for $3,000 a pound, you could pay someone $200, $300, $400 a pound to trim it for you. And we've seen that over the years where we had the trimmigrants coming into town and getting a lot of money to trim for 3 to 4 months in a season and then go back to wherever they came from. And well, that's not happening anymore. When you have marijuana that's selling between $300 to $500 a pound, labor and trimming the marijuana has become a huge liability for the farmers. And so how do you combat that? You combat that by forcing labor, by having labor trucked in to your facilities, to your gardens. And oftentimes these are people that are non-documented, that are people from foreign nations that are coming in and that are working these farms. What we found is when we come and do search warrants at these locations, that these individuals don't want to talk with us. These people don't want to give statements. We believe that they're trafficked. We believe that they are victims of crime. But we didn't have the resources to actually help investigate that.
Also involved in the law enforcement effort is gaining evidence through software extraction from electronic devices like cell phones. Hansel emphasized that electronic evidence will be collected under strict requirements, including search warrants. And he said victim advocacy, not immigration enforcement, is the goal.
As far as the undocumented people in the country illegally, it is not something that is the focus of the coalition. Again, we can't enforce immigration law. That's not something that a state employee can ever do or a county employee can ever do. So that's not a part of our a part of what we do. And we're not bringing in immigration and customs, you know, to do an immigration check on the people that are working in these illegal industries. What we're doing is, like I said before, is coming in with law enforcement gear and uniform, and how we conduct a search warrant isn't conducive to do a soft interview on people that are actually there. And so what we want to do, and what we have been trying to do, is bringing civilians, bringing victim advocates, the people that don't have the badge and the gun, to sit down to look at. We have the ability to do language software out in the field, even if there's no connectivity. We have that ability through the coalition. And that we can actually do language line, we can do Google Translate, those kind of things out in the field with our civilian employees, with our victim advocates, to speak with people that are potentially being trafficked.
Supervisors supported the intent, but Supervisor Natalie Arroyo has concerns about grant-funded positions being temporary. Due to that, she voted against approval of the positions. But hers was the only dissenting vote, and the positions were approved. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Turning to Mendocino, get ready for a timeless tradition as the annual Sheepdog Trials returns to the Mendocino County Fairgrounds in Boonville this September. KZYX's Sydney Fishman brings you the details.
The annual Sheepdog Trials will be held this September 15th at the Mendocino County Fairgrounds in Boonville. The historic event, held annually during the Mendocino County Fair, will happen inside the Rodeo Arena. The competitive event dates back to the 1860s in both New Zealand and Wales, but the exact origin is unclear. The sport gained popularity and eventually spread to Australia and other countries worldwide. The Redwood Empire region of Northern California developed this specific kind of sheepdog trial in the 1940s because of Mendocino County's rough terrain. In this event, herding dogs show their skills by moving sheep around fences and gates. A judge assesses their performance to see how well the dogs can guide the sheep into different enclosures. Kevin Owens, a former contestant and two-time first-place winner of the Mendocino County Sheepdog Trials, says that while there are many kinds of herding dogs, Border Collies are his personal favorite for the competition.
The Border Collie wants to do his work. So that's when they're really happy, is when they're working. And so you never have to tell a Border Collie to work. You have to tell them not to work.
W. Dan, who hosts the programs The Discussion and The Treehouse at KZYX Radio, produces an annual broadcast with Kevin at the Sheepdog Trials to describe the excitement of the event to listeners.
It's unique. The Redwood Empire Sheepdog Association trials are not done anywhere else. This is the only place in the U.S. or anywhere in the world that they do them like this. We're sitting there right in the front row. We're there with the crowd. I've gotten into the habit of, announcing that we're on the radio and a show of hands, how many people are listening, and quite a few people, 20 or 30 people in the crowd will raise their hands and wave back at us as we're talking. No, we're live on the air at the Mendocino County Fairgrounds. It's a bit like a baseball game, it's an audio medium, so we have to let people know what the weather's like and a bit about how the dog is approaching the sheep. A lot of times they'll get down into what I call a soldier's crawl, where they're kind of on their belly and slowly creeping up on the sheep. And then other times they're streaking along the lines, the sidelines, like a track sprinter. So it's a job of explaining to the listener who's not there the excitement and the feel of what's going on with the sheepdog trials.
The Mendocino County sheepdog trials are normally based on a 50-point scoring system and last for about 10 minutes. Each contestant starts with 50 points and can lose points if the sheepdog does something that the judge doesn't approve of. Some of the main tasks the sheepdogs need to do to win are the outrun, the lift, and the fetch of the sheep.
So the dog on his run is running in a straight line along to get those sheep. And then the lift is picking up the sheep and bringing them, fetching them back to the handler and around the handler. So that's the outrun, lift, and fetch, and that's 15 points.
Near the end of the event, there's an obstacle called a shoe, which is a small funnel-like structure. This is one of the most difficult parts of the competition for sheepdogs and their handlers.
10 feet wide at the mouth and 16 inches wide at the neck. It's only wide enough for one sheep.
A bit like a funnel if you look at it from the top, or a big Y.
And again, the handler's off standing on the panel giving direction. And that's worth 10 points. And a lot of times handlers won't be able to get the sheep through there, but they have to make a couple of attempts. So after at least two attempts, they move on usually to the pen. And the same thing at the pen, you go to the pen, you open up the gate, you stand on the base, and the dog has to put the sheep into the pen. And then the handler closes the gate, and that's the end of the trial.
For the hardworking sheepdogs, the big treat from their owners for completing the competition is not a big chunk of meat or even ice cream, but the feeling of accomplishment when finishing the event.
A lot of love, people will, hug the dog and scratch its ears. And, that dog is just happy being out there. That's the reward.
To listen to the broadcast of the Mendocino County Fair's Sheepdog Trials and hear more from W. Dan and Kevin, turn your dial to KZYX on Sunday, September 15th at 10 a.m. For KZYX News, I'm Sydney Fishman.
In state news, state lawmakers considered a bill to make California the first state in the nation to create AI safeguards as congressional deadlines loom. KPFA's Christopher Martinez brings you this report.
The issue of artificial intelligence, or AI, has been debated in Congress in committee hearings, but so far, no action. So Democratic State Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco wants California to step in. He spoke in a virtual news conference Monday.
California has a responsibility as the bastion of technology innovation. We have a responsibility to lead on safe and responsible innovation.
Wiener has authored Senate Bill 1047, the Safe and Secure Innovation for Frontier Artificial Intelligence Models Act. Its aim is to create guardrails for the developers of the biggest, most expensive AI systems to prevent their causing critical harm. The bill defines that as mass casualties, more than $500 million of economic damage, or comparable harms. Wiener described some of the possible threats posed by AI without safeguards.
The ability to shut down the electric grid, the ability to create a biological weapon, the ability to melt down the banking system. These are not made up science fiction risks. These are very real risks. And for those opponents who are claiming that the risks are science fiction, you have to question, then why are they opposing the bill? If they really think the risks are fake, then the bill should present no issue whatsoever.
Wiener says his bill only affects a handful of the largest AI companies, those developing the largest and most advanced AI systems, costing more than $100 million in computing power. The bill would require those companies to set up safety protocols and have the ability to shut down the system. The measure also has protections for whistleblowers. Opponents of the bill say there's no real threat and the bill would stifle innovation. Supporters disagree on both counts.
This is a fundamental question of who decides. And we can decide to have both innovation and safety. And in fact, we must decide to have both.
Terry Oley is director of the group Economic Security California, one of SB 1047's sponsors. She calls the bill an important step that could ensure that AI benefits everybody.
We've seen the consequences of leaving tech unregulated with social media. Technology made with the best intentions can cause harm down the road. And we've had a chance to get ahead of similar problem. We have a chance now to get ahead of similar type problems with AI, and we need to seize this opportunity.
Another supporter of the bill, Sunny Gandhi, is vice president of political affairs for the group Encode Justice, another of the bill's sponsors. He says this is a critical moment as we see the power of technology to connect people and also to spread disinformation. He says the bill simply codifies the best practices that have already been adopted by some companies.
California has long balanced innovation with responsibility in other fields such as environmental protection, consumer privacy, and automobile safety. SB 1047 continues this approach, ensuring that we advance AI technology thoughtfully and safely. This bill isn't about stifling progress. It's about nurturing an ecosystem where groundbreaking innovations can flourish responsibly. By implementing these common sense measures, we are not just safeguarding against potential harms, we are cultivating public trust in AI technologies. This trust is the bedrock upon the future of which AI will be built.
SB 1047 faces an end-of-the-month deadline to pass out of the full assembly. Wiener says he never predicts the future when it comes to legislation, but he says he's proud of growing support from AI startup companies. He also points out the measure has passed out of the Senate on a vote of 32-1, and in the Assembly, it's passed out of its two policy committees with only one no vote. As for whether Governor Gavin Newsom would sign the bill, that is a big question mark. And for Wiener, perhaps no news is good news.
As for the governor, I do not know the governor's position. He has been clear that he is not stating a position, which is typical. The governor would usually not state a position until the bill comes to his desk. The governor has made statements that are very consistent with my own thinking, that we want to regulation can be appropriate here, and we want to make sure that we're fostering innovation as well. And I agree with the governor's statements in that regard.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
In national news, members of Congress from both sides of the aisle were in Butler County, Pennsylvania, assessing the Butler Farm showgrounds where former President Donald Trump survived an assassination attempt last month. KPFA's Scott Baba reports.
The bipartisan Congressional Task Force on the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump went to Pennsylvania to meet with local law enforcement and examine the location where the shooting took place. As part of the visit, members of Congress went onto the roof of the building, where gunman Thomas Matthew Crooks fired 8 shots, injuring Trump and audience members David Dutch and Jim Copenhaver, and killing another audience member, Corey Comparator. Republican Representative Mike Kelly is co-chair for the task force and represents the part of Pennsylvania that includes Butler County. He said that it was vital that the task force visit the grounds themselves.
When you're actually here on this surface, when you're actually walking in these grounds, when you're actually going to the building, when you're actually up on the roof, when you're actually looking at where did we have people positioned, where was the shooter positioned, if you can actually look at that right now in person, then all the rest of the pictures right away, it's like, okay, I got it. I know where that was. So the big thing for us being here today was to actually be on the ground, get familiar with the ground, be comfortable with the questions we were going to ask because of the way it was laid out.
Kelly stressed the bipartisan nature of the task force.
There's not one person on this conference that's identifying just as a Republican or a Democrat. We're identifying as members of Congress on a task force with a task to restore the faith and trust and confidence the American people have to have in our system.
Democratic Representative Jason Crow of Colorado is the other co-chair of the task force. He echoed Kelly's comments and said it was vital that they set aside partisan infighting on the issue.
I think that sends a very strong message that you don't have to be a Democrat or a Republican or an unaffiliated to say that there's no room for political violence in America. You know, we have debates. We're going to have tough debates, and we're in the midst of a election cycle right now, and all of us are going to have those tough debates. But in the United States of America, you do not get to attempt to assassinate our elected officials and our candidates. It's unacceptable. And we are standing here in a bipartisan way to send the message that we won't tolerate it.
Democratic Representative Chrissy Houlihan of Pennsylvania said that she wanted to get a better idea of the breakdown in process that led to the assassination attempt.
By my background, I'm a military officer, Air Force, but also an engineer and an operator. I spent most of my life in operations. And so what I'm going to be spending my time on is trying to understand what happened in terms of procedures and protocols to make sure that we understand that. And specifically, also we'll be focusing on some new technologies such as the drone that was involved in this particular situation.
Meanwhile, on the same day the task force visited Butler, Pennsylvania, right-wing congressional Republicans held their own forum on the assassination attempt at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. That panel was led by Republican Representatives Corey Mills of Florida and Eli Crane of Arizona. Crane has made unsubstantiated claims that the shooting was part of a coordinated campaign by Democrats or shadowy government actors to stop Trump from being reelected. The Republican Forum heard testimony from Dan Bongino, a former Secret Service agent who is now a conservative political commentator, Eric Prince, the founder of the private military contractor Blackwater, and Ben Schaefer, a member of the SWAT team who says he was on the scene that day and felt unprepared. Republican Representative Tim Gates of Florida said that the testimony he'd heard led him to believe the security failure around Trump the day of the assassination attempt rose to a level that he believed could have been intentional.
I worry about the political capture happening at headquarters and then that culture informing decisions in a way that's very damaging to the country. So what Mr. Bongino just said ought to be the most important work of the United States Congress, to figure out if these decisions were run-of-the-mill incompetence that you've got to deal with the better tech and the better processes and the better HR and getting rid of the DEI. But if it's something even darker and more devious than that, that must be rooted out. Because what we've seen at these other agencies of government is it does not cure itself. It has to be excised.
Members of the bipartisan panel declined to answer questions about what preliminary findings they might have. A spokesperson for the U.S. Secret Service said the agency is cooperating with oversight efforts by the House Congressional Task Force, as well as the Department of Homeland Security's Independent Review Panel, the DHS Office of the Inspector General, and the FBI. I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
This coming Saturday, the Lost Coast will be the scenic backdrop to a beloved community fundraiser for the Heart of the Redwoods Hospice during the annual Taste of the Cove event.
Well, this is our 21st annual Taste of the Cove, and it's our biggest fundraiser, and we love doing it, and we love seeing everyone. It's on August 31st this year, 1 to 5. It's always on the Saturday of Labor Day, and this year it's early.
You just heard from Heart of the Redwoods Hospice board member Sandy Tillis. The annual hospice fundraiser offers residents and visitors exactly what the event's name promises, a taste of the Cove.
A lot of volunteers and a lot of generous contributors. All the fish are all donated by the local fishermen from Shelter Cove, and a lot of the produce is donated, and we have over 100 volunteers, and it's a real community work in progress. It's amazing.
Not only is the food locally sourced, so is the entertainment.
We also have great music, local music. This year, April Moore's new band, The Saddle Tramps, is playing with K-Mud Shear Brown and Ed Shear and Ray and Mumser and April Moore. It's going to be amazing. And then Ray Bevatori and friends, that's Ray and Michael Curran and Josh Amay, another K-Mud regular. And then the last band, the headliners, are Soham Girls Band with Marsha Mendels, another K-Mud DJ.
Additionally, Taste of the Cove will offer a kids zone and puppeteer, encouraging the whole family to come out and enjoy. Aside from reveling in the beautiful scenery, delicious food, and family fun, attendees of Taste of the Cove are supporting Heart of the Redwoods Hospice's mission to provide education, empowerment, and support to patients, their families, and the community throughout the dying and grieving process.
Well, they allow the loved one to die at home, essentially. or die on their own terms. You know, if it gets to the point where they can't be at home, then we help them transition into a place where they can be. However, with the hospice support and a really good circle of care, the client can have his wishes to die in the peace of his own home. And nurses work with the client's doctors to provide the proper medication so that they can be comfortable. And they'll help also with making arrangements for the final care of the body. We can find volunteers to help in the home with chores or errands, or even to the point of helping taking someone to the doctor. Whatever the needs are, we have some volunteers that can do that. It's really about being peaceful and comfortable.
This fundraiser is the largest fundraising event to support Heart of the Redwoods Hospice and the support they provide to families as their loved ones transition.
Well, we're a nonprofit independent hospice, so we don't get any Medicare or insurance funding. So these funds go directly to paying our staff, and our staff is primarily our nurses and our bereavement people and our office staff. So thanks to our sponsors, all the money that is generated goes straight into the programs.
As always, the Heart of the Redwoods Hospice offers their services free of charge. Thanks to community donations, generous support of sponsors, and fundraising efforts like Taste of the Cove.
We're so grateful to our community, and we love seeing everyone come out.
The 21st annual Taste of the Cove event will be held this Saturday, August 31st, from 1 to 5 p.m. in Shelter Cove at Malcolm's Park near the Lighthouse, with a Pioneer-sponsored bake sale, raffle, local music, and locally sourced and donated seafood as the community and attendees come together to support the important work of Heart of the Redwoods Hospice. For more information, call 707-923-7276. That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Sydney Fishman, Christopher Martinez, Scott Baba, and Emily Burris. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.